Hello, and welcome to the third edition of Posted, the audio newsletter of Poster House, the first and only museum devoted to posters in the United States. I'm Stephen Heller. Since opening last spring, the galleries have been abuzz with individual and student groups, and 2020 promises to be another exciting year, beginning with two exhibitions designed to inspire and inform. In the main gallery, an extensive exhibition of Chinese posters from the 1920s through the Maoist and Cultural Revolutionary period on up to the 2000s. And in the lower level galleries, a show on the Swiss grid, the most impactful graphic design tool of the modern era. To talk about Chinese posters and their history and their significance, here is Angelina Lippert, Chief Curator of Poster House. Hi, Angelina.
Hi, Steve.
Angelina, I did not know that Napoleon Bonaparte was responsible for the quote, "China is a sleeping giant. Let her sleep, for when she wakes, she will move the world."
So the quote is attributed to Napoleon, but it's taken on a life of its own. Numerous books, newspaper articles, and political speeches reference that quote. And there's even a Chinese translation in which China is a sleeping lion. For me, these words have staying power because they touch on China's economic potential and shifting ties to the West, which are important issues at the core of this show.
You know, Angelina, I collected commercial posters from the pre-communist era.
Really?
Yeah, they advertised liquor, tobacco, cosmetics, and pharmaceuticals, among other things. They all had a common design. Usually they were paintings of elegantly dressed and stylish Chinese women, something like pinups in the broadest sense.
Did you buy any?
I had many of them. How were these posters determined and designed? And when?
Well, when the exhibition begins in the early 20th century, Western powers have already forced their way into Chinese markets and are benefiting from the numerous concessions granted by the weakening Qing dynasty. Throughout the 20s and 30s, foreign and local companies rapidly expanded their commercial activities in China.
Hurt finger. Band-aid plastic bandage and collar. Ah!
And when they brought products like perfume, soap to China, they thought, how do we appeal to a Chinese audience? You figure the same way you appeal to a Western audience, beautiful women selling products. The most popular posters were referred to as calendar posters or yufenpai. They were a combination of promotional calendars popular in the United States and traditional Chinese New Year calendars. Several calendar posters in the exhibition were issued by well-known foreign companies like Nestle and DuPont. Both feature Western-style illustrations of Chinese ladies and use Chinese-inspired landscapes as a backdrop. Advertisers learned that the best way to create calendar posters that resonated with Chinese audiences was to hire local talent. Foreign-owned companies staffed their art departments with Chinese artists or hired artist studios. The Nestle calendar poster, for example, was created by a studio that operated in a sort of assembly line fashion, where one person specialized in lettering, another in faces, another in clothing, etc. These assignments were given based on each artist's strengths as illustrators.
That's fascinating. Once the nationalists were defeated in the Civil War with the Communist Party led by Mao, Yunfeipei posters gave way to propaganda that echoed Soviet socialist realism. How immediate and complete was this transformation?
Well, it's important to remember that during China's last decade under the nationalists, there was a lot going on. There were political posters made during the Second Sino-Japanese War, which later became part of World War II. And the nationalists and the communists were on the same side for Chinese resistance and against Japanese occupation. And both nationalists and communist artists produced their own posters for the conflict in their own aesthetic. And all of this was happening while calendar posters were still in circulation. Now, by the 1950s, under the Communist People's Republic of China, Mao managed to centralize poster production. In China's new planned economy, where manufacturing targets, new investments, even incomes were all determined by the state, the need for advertising disappears. So several calendar poster artists, brilliantly secured positions in making posters for the communist government. Among them were Li and Jin in the exhibition, who were collaborators who began their careers in the same Shanghai studio.
Yeah, so Angelina, this is really exciting for me because it brings back when I was in my hippie days in the mid-late to 1960s, not too far away from where Poster House is now. I visited a bookstore on Fifth Avenue called China Books and Periodicals. I went practically every week.
Really?
Yeah, you could buy posters and silk wall hangings and booklets and pamphlets for literally 25 to 50 cents. They were usually official portraits of communist leaders, both Chinese and Soviet and elsewhere.
Okay.
But they were also anti-West posters and propaganda and pro-economic plan posters.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you know, when did the PRC change its poster focus to internal economy?
Mm-hmm.
And do you know how a shop like China Books and Periodicals, which only closed a little while ago, got a foothold in New York City?
Well, that's a funny story. Your purchases were facilitated by the Chinese Communist government. China Books and Periodicals began in Chicago in 1960 and had other locations in San Francisco and New York. So you could also buy books through their mail order catalog. Yet, according to past employees, this American distributor and bookseller worked directly with the PRC's Foreign Language Publishing Bureau to import their wares. And finding ways to circulate positive propaganda about your nation is just what government departments like this do. So China Books and Periodicals gained a foothold because it was one of the few ways individuals in the U.S. could obtain publications and posters directly from China. Sort of like Mao's Little Red Book, which we all know, that was circulated the world over to promote positive propaganda for the Chinese government.
Yeah, I have about 10 different editions in different languages.
No, exactly. The first time my dad came back from China, he brought me a copy. It's every tourist gets one. They were at every communist bookstore around the world, really. And they were very, very inexpensive. And when the Little Red Book came out in China, the government took over basically all of China's printing industry to produce tens of thousands of copies. But as far as posters are concerned, the majority of posters produced by the PRC's government that were on sale in these stores were really for domestic Chinese audiences. Even when these posters referenced seemingly international issues, they did so with a domestic goal in mind. So in the exhibition, there's a 1953 poster that reads, "With the great support of the Soviet Union and our own greatest strengths, we will realize the industrialization of our nation step by step." So wordy. It features two very handsome Chinese and Russian men shaking hands. And early posters like that one showcasing China's Soviet alliance were meant to reassure citizens that planned economies like the one in the Soviet Union were already operating successfully. So trust in government and in socialism.
And those posters scared the bejesus out of most Americans.
Yeah, totally.
When did the style of the poster change to reflect the reform policies of the Deng Xiaoping era?
Well, the Cultural Revolution was a tumultuous period in the PRC. By the time Deng and his allies gained power in the late 70s, Mao has been dead for several years, and the Cultural Revolution is over. Both leaders had very different economic philosophies. Under Deng, China began to strategically interact with the capitalist marketplace. In the early 80s, the PRC established four, quote, special economic zones on the South China Sea. Foreign investors could now open outposts in these special economic zones so long as they partnered with domestic Chinese business. Another major reform was lifting the ban on international and domestic product advertising. And finally, non-government propaganda posters can actually exist. This opened the door for a new profession of graphic design and marketing outside of the state's propaganda system.
I'm pretty sure that many people who think they know Chinese propaganda posters have a more stereotypical view than what's actually shown in this eye-opening exhibit. There's a long history of the Chinese poster that gets buried under the weight of the Cultural Revolutionary images. This exhibition broadens the scope and expands the history of Chinese poster design and content. And so thank you for all your insights.
Thanks.
Den großen Schritt machte Josef Müller-Brockmann Anfang der 50er Jahre.
Das ist ein Plakat für die Tonhalle Zürich, für das Konzert. Und er versucht dann Typografie und die geometrischen Elemente in Übereinstimmung.
So this season's second exhibit is at once historical and contemporary, insofar as it's about the building blocks of modern graphic design. Let's talk about the development of Swiss style and the Swiss grid. Every graphic designer studies the Swiss grid at some point. Some swear by it, others swear at it, like me. The debate is on one side that it is design precision at its most impeccable, while on the other side it's standardization at its most sterile. Given the way metal type was composed in the past, certain design has always relied on geometric structures. But in the early 1950s, when the Swiss grid was introduced in Zurich and Basel, it was considered a kind of religious transformation. Everything is more or less designed on a grid structure. But what is the key difference between the grid and the Swiss grid? And why did the Swiss grid so significantly alter graphic design?
Well, from about the 1870s, when posters first were developed, up through the 1950s, most posters were illustrational. Through either stone lithography or photo offset printing, artists would create beautiful, expressive designs that were mass-produced to promote products, PSAs, and events. And each country had its major artists and their own particular flair or design style. And then World War II happened. Many of the greatest artists, especially poster artists, died either fighting or in concentration camps. Others found refuge within Switzerland because it remained neutral during the war. So the country became this unique melting pot of artists from all over Europe. Some, like Max Bill, studied at the Bauhaus and brought with him all of his theories on concrete art, which is a style that relies heavily on geometry and mathematics and is related to other movements like constructivism and de Stijl.
It sounds like the Swiss grid is really an avant-garde manifestation.
It definitely has its roots there. I mean, you have all these cutting-edge artistic thinkers, and you have a country with dedicated operational design schools. One of the most important instructors at the Zurich School, the Kunstgewerbeschule, is Ernst Keller. And his primary concern in design is clarity of communication, which is a really complicated task in a country where you have four official languages. So any poster being printed in Switzerland had to typically be reprinted in, at the very least, French and German, though often also in Italian and maybe Romansh. To redesign a poster two, three, sometimes four times is a massive pain, and certainly not very efficient. So Keller and others took the principles of concrete art and other math-based compositional theories and put them to functional use.
Ja, Rittersport, Schokolade live, köstlich knackig.
Schokoladig.
Quadratisch, praktisch.
Good.
Suddenly you have these pared-down images that so clearly tell you what they're promoting or advertising. And they can include lines in as many languages as you want, because there's this gridded backbone that keeps everything in its own neat little column or area. And this completely changed the course of graphic design because designers were no longer seen as artists, but as communication engineers, problem solvers.
Schöpfer des Expo-Signetes und dieser zwei Briefmarken ist der Grafiker Armin Hoffmann, der diese Woche in künstlerischer Mission nach Indien fliegt.
I think this is beautifully demonstrated in any of Armin Hoffmann's posters for the City Theatre in Basel. He creates an atmospheric design through the use of objective photography that isn't necessarily tied to a single production or show. And he uses the grid to demarcate an area where a weekly schedule of performances can sit. So from a business standpoint, you now have an evergreen image and you don't need to spend more money designing and printing a new poster each week. You can just change the necessary programming schedule.
In meinem Fall geht's also um Grafik, um Schrift und Bild, Reproduktion.
This is also the time when corporations start expanding internationally and brands start wanting distinctive identities to separate themselves from the competition. Through this new design philosophy, you have an accessible, clean method of creating clear design and brand identities on a global scale that work in every market. The chemical company Geigy is perhaps the best example of this from the period, because all of their ads, their packaging, everything, no matter where one is in the world, they all look like they're part of the same brand.
This sounds like the essence of capitalist design. Just look at all those multinational companies that emerge in the post-war period. And specifically, their graphics. They're very similar. They're quite geometrical, sometimes abstract.
Mm-hmm.
I always presume that the Bauhaus typography workshops, and especially Jan Tschichold, who was not at the Bauhaus but codified the new typography, gave birth to the grid long ago in the Dessau days. So why did Switzerland become the putative father of this grid?
Well, you're not wrong. In typography, metal type and really anything requiring a lockup in printing forces you to structure an image in a horizontal and vertical order, so essentially a grid. And all of these Swiss designers were aware of and inspired by Bauhaus theories, and especially by Jan Tschichold's new typography. But the Bauhaus was no longer operational in the 1950s, and no one at the Bauhaus, to my knowledge, wrote extensively on grid systems and design. Plenty wrote about and practiced the application of geometry and art, though, and those artists greatly influenced what would happen in Switzerland. More importantly, the post-war years in Switzerland were a perfect storm of situations that allowed for a rather intellectual approach to design to happen. You have an influx of some of the greatest surviving members of the avant-garde living and teaching within the country. You have many schools dedicated to teaching design as a functional career path rather than just art for art's sake. You have museums that are promoting shows like Good Design and The Best Swiss Poster, and having the winners of those competitions, almost all of whom teach at these design schools, creating the posters for these shows. And you have companies, most of which, incidentally, have headquarters in Zurich or Basel, which is where the two biggest design schools are located, and they want fresh design. So you get this pipeline of sorts where museums hire design school teachers to create design, which inspires companies to hire the same designers to create their design, and you end up with a pervasive, impactful look that explodes throughout Europe, the United States, and parts of Asia.
Yeah, Switzerland was kind of a mecca for designers from all over the world. Paul Rand, for example, would go to Switzerland every year to Brissago, where he taught.
Really?
Yep.
Wait, and didn't he make Joseph Müller-Brockmann the
IBM?
Yeah, the head of IBM's design in Europe?
Exactly. Brockmann was head of IBM's design, and Hoffman came to Yale in New Haven. The grid is really, as we said, closely identified with corporate identity manuals. It seems this process requires a certain mathematical skill. And could it be that graphic design was forever altered by this?
Yes. Geometry is definitely the backbone of this process. So if you can't divide a page by thirds, you're kind of in trouble. But corporate and also government identities are really the best surviving examples of how this style is so pervasive. The National Parks Guides were designed by Müller-Brockmann. The New York City subway system, that's Massimo Vignelli. Pharmaceutical labels, public signage, most corporate letterhead, your tax forms, all of this still comes from grid-based design. And this all exploded when the computer came along. All of those default fonts that came on Microsoft Word derived from typefaces used and developed by Swiss designers. There's a reason everything is in Helvetica today, which incidentally translates as the Swiss one or that which is Swiss.
You know, it's funny, in the early to mid-60s, the Beatles were the group we looked at as our biggest influence. At the same time, the designers were Swiss. It was as though Hoffman, Müller-Brockmann, Lohse, Bill, these were the Beatles of graphic design.
Totally.
And there were certain camps that developed. Wolfgang Weingart, for example, who was a little later.
The Swiss punk movement.
The Swiss punk. And there were some diverging ideas that happened, like Swiss punk. Why did the Swiss grid cause this bifurcation?
Well, the two camps happened really fairly early on. It was a division between Basel and Zurich. Each of those schools attracted different professors. So in Zurich, Joseph Müller-Brockmann became the superstar of the grid. And that's mostly because he is the most prolific writer on grid systems.
Müller-Brockmann warb natürlich nicht nur für die Zürcher Tonhalle, doch er nahm längst nicht jeden Auftrag an.
Also ich habe ein schönes Beispiel erlebt mit der Schweizer, mit der grossen Schweizer Chalet-Fabrikation. Dann hätte ich mich auch gefragt, ob ich ihnen die Werbung mache.
But other students and professors in Zurich, like Losa and Carlo Vivarelli, all contributed to the seemingly regimented approach to design. I've heard stories that students of Brockmann sat in utter silence while they worked, sort of like a really intense Zen design meditation. Meanwhile, in Basel, Armin Hoffmann worked alongside Emil Ruder and Carl Gerstner, and they all had slightly different uses for grid systems. Some say that Hoffmann didn't use a grid at all, but that's not really true. All of these designers in both camps put their own spin on what a grid could bring to visual communication.
I've heard the term flexible grid.
Yeah.
Can you explain flexible grid to me?
Sure. The term flexible grid just basically acknowledges that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to design. When building a composition, the designer needs to ask what problem are they trying to solve, what needs to be communicated. And from that, he or she can begin laying out the page. The grid is just a backbone upon which you can fit all the design elements necessary to express that information. So don't picture a grid like the graph paper we have in school. Picture instead a series of vertical and horizontal lines that divide spaces in accordance with the information you want to include. So let's say you have a huge horizontal photograph and you want it to be the focal point of the poster. Do you divide the page in half horizontally and place the photo in the upper register? Then do you take that remaining lower half of the page and divide it vertically so you end up with two columns of text? Maybe it looks better if you divide it into thirds. That's obviously a very simplistic example, but the entire process is really this dance between design elements, weighing the visuals to see what creates the most satisfying and balanced composition that also communicates information succinctly and clearly. It's actually not a very rigid approach to design at all, but merely a tool that gives you the best possible chance of creating something clear and impactful.
You know, it sounds suspiciously like InDesign on the computer. So, well, with the underlying grid structure, there is literally more to design than meets the eye. This exhibition, however, puts it in focus. Thank you so much, Angelina.
Thanks, Steve.
That's it for this episode of Posted, the audio newsletter of Poster House. Thanks to our curators, Angelina Lippert and Steffi Duarte. Our executive producer is the director of Poster House, Julia Knight. Our producer is Pike Malinowski. Original music by Bob Pounding. And I'm your host, Stephen Heller. Thanks for listening. For future exhibitions and events, stay posted.